one point I felt like I did. The truth is, none of us have all the answers. And the more I study and read, the more questions I have, the less answers I have. But the more effective I feel like I am as a coach. Constantly learning and trying to improve, that's a good coach. Constantly learning and trying to improve. Some principles for you as a beginning coach. Remember, this is not about X's and O's. You can get that in any book out there. Find your sport. Look for the X's and O's. They're out there. What about the art of coaching, the things that go beyond the X's and O's? That's what this video is about. A lot of things I've given thought to over the years, a lot of changes that I've gone through as a coach that I've tried to put into some principles here of coaching for the beginning coach. And here they are. Principle number one, place the athlete first. Who is the experience for? It's not for you as the coach. One thing I'm sure of is that in the coaching profession, we have egos, a lot of egos, and that can be a problem because it's not about the coach. When I was early in my experience, how my teams did, I felt like that performance was a reflection on me as a coach. And so I took it personally when we didn't do well. It is not about the coach. It is about the athlete. When we understand that what we do and how we do it has to be about the athlete and not the coach, that is a huge first step for us, a step that took me quite a bit of time to take, but has made me a much better coach once I finally realized that. What is the real goal of the sport experience? Give some thought to that question. In my opinion, it's not about athletics at all. It is about creating stronger people. Athletics is the forum we use to create stronger people. It's a wonderful forum because it provides a ready-made test in a lot of ways, both internal and external. But it really is about creating character and strength of character through the process of sport. Ask yourself if the situation you have or that you want to have will be built upon that I really want to create stronger people first, better athletes second. If you do, I think you'll find that that's a healthier way to develop your program in terms of design. Giving and not taking. It's a hard thing to do, to not be selfish. But that's what we have to do as coaches. We are in a giving profession. We are giving our knowledge. We are teaching other people what we know and not taking from the process and not building our own egos. It's a very hard thing to give up the ego. Chasing external approval versus internal. This is a hard thing to do, you know. When I was an athlete back in the mid-70s, I remember at the Olympic trials, they asked us some questions. The sports psychologist came in and gave a survey out, and they asked a question to us. Here it was. If you could take drugs, and as a result of the drug use, win a gold medal at the Olympic Games, but as a result of the drug use, die within 5 years from liver disease, would you take the drugs? And over 50% said yes, they would. Over 50% said they would die for that 15 minutes of fame. Now, what does that tell you? That the problem with drug use is not athletics. It is self-esteem. It's self-esteem that people will do this kind of thing for recognition for that 15 minutes in their life. Chasing external approval. One of the goals we have to put out there for us as coaches is to create a situation where the athlete seeks their own approval, that what's most important is how they feel about themselves and not what other people feel. Because when we are defined from the outside in instead of from the inside out, that's a real risky proposition. You lose yourself, you lose your soul in the process, and you allow others to define who you are. That can be a problem. Placing the athlete first means developing a trusting relationship with the athlete. Take the time to do that. It's very rewarding to take the time to do that. In our situation, we have individual meetings with our athletes at the very start of the season and also at the end of the season. And the purpose is to get to know them, to develop a trusting relationship, to take an interest, to show them that you are interested in them regardless of ability. It goes a long way when you do something like that. It took me a while to understand that, but I spend the time to do it because I know it's critical now. Principle number one, place the athlete first. The second principle is this: the successful coach continues to learn and is always prepared. I told you the story of my background. You know, I studied a lot through the 80s and 90s. I really wanted to learn how to coach. Spent a lot of time on the X's and O's. And I remember going to the Olympic Training Center back in the late 80s for a USA Track and Field Level 2 school. I think it was the second one they offered at the time. And I felt like I knew as much as anybody. I'd written a couple books, I had done dozens of articles, lots of clinics, and just felt like I have the answers for this sport. Well, I went through this school, 8-day school, and came away from there absolutely blown away, shocked even, at how little I really knew. This was a very high-level school, got into things I had no clue about, had never read about. So in a way, it was exciting, tremendously exciting, and yet, in a way, it was also hard on the ego. And it was needed, of course, at the time, because the truth was I didn't have very many answers at all. And what it showed me is how much there is out there to learn if you just take the time to learn. I mentioned earlier the joy of learning. There really is no greater joy, in my opinion, on a professional level for a teacher and a coach to learn new material, to get excited about new material. When I took over cross country and began to have a little success, I really got inspired to learn, to read all of the great coaches, to find out what was working and what wasn't and why. I just got excited about learning. I remember taking a trip out to Colorado one year to spend a week with one of the great coaches, Joe Vigil, and just shadow him. And what a wonderful time that was. Went in and he said, you know, Will, you're here for 5 full days, and here's how we're going to deal with it. You come up with 5 questions, and I'll take a question each day, and we'll spend the whole day on the question. It was amazing. I mean, here was one of the great physiologists and coaches out there, maybe our greatest distance coach in the United States. And what a wonderful experience that was. You talk about the joy of learning, just listening and taking notes and thriving in that kind of environment. Just pure excitement about learning. I recommend it to you. You know, whether it's meeting with other coaches, going to clinics, reading, but the joy of learning is like no other joy. And who benefits the most? The athletes, ultimately. You know, a lot of coaches are afraid of change and afraid of learning. They get stuck in their ways. I see this a lot with older coaches. They've done things a certain way for so many years, they just don't want to change. It's a simple comfort zone issue. They don't want to get out of the comfort zone. And yet, here we are as coaches asking our athletes all the time to get out of the comfort zone. Why don't we learn by doing? You know, show them by doing ourselves. Get out of the comfort zone. Be willing to change. Take a chance. Take a risk. And change things we've done that may not be effective. Not necessarily a problem for the beginning coach, but it's something to be concerned with down the line. I've seen a lot of it in older coaches. Challenge the athletes to know what you know. You know, a lot of coaches are afraid to do that, but one of the things I tell my athletes when they come in as a freshman is, by the time you're a senior, you better know as much as I know. Remember, this is for you, not for me. So I haven't done my job unless you know everything I know, if not more than I know by the time you're out of here. Challenge them to do that. They'll get excited about learning. And they'll realize that you're opening yourself up. And that vulnerability can be attractive because the athlete believes that you really care enough about them to challenge them to do that. It's a very inspiring thing. Confidence comes from knowledge, both as a coach and as an athlete. Confidence comes from knowledge. Think about that. Are you confident in what you are going to do with your athletes in your program? If you're not, get out there and learn. Try things. Take a chance. Keep records all the time. Keep records so that you can go back and analyze after the fact. As I tell people all the time, when it comes to training design and workout design for track and field and cross country, how do you know it works if you haven't kept records? Even a bad plan can offer you something after the fact. So a bad plan's better than no plan, but keep records of everything. How do you learn? Well, there's a number of mechanisms. Contacts with other coaches. Don't be afraid to pick up the phone and phone another coach or phone someone up at the university nearby explaining what you're trying to find. They'll be excited that you're excited about learning. You'll be amazed how many people will open up and teach you what they know. Clinics. Read everything you can get your hands on. And what a wonderful thing, the internet. There's so much information out there on the internet now. It's a library just waiting for you. Get excited and take the first step to increase your knowledge base. Principle 2, the successful coach continues to learn and is always prepared. Principle 3, promote self-belief and self-respect within the athlete. The athlete is part of the process. They have to be brought in as part of the process. It can't be the coach talking down to the athlete. It has to be a one-to-one thing. Remember, they're the ones doing it. It is their program. It is their thing. We are there for leadership and guidance, but it is not our thing. They have to be a part of the process. And when they feel like they're part of the process, that trust in between coach and athlete is developed to the point where you can get so much more done. There can be so much more belief in you when you allow them into the process. Use your athlete's input to make a stronger team. A lot of coaches have a fear in giving up control, meaning they prefer to be up here above the athletes and have the athletes down here below them. I've tried it. It doesn't work. Give up the control. Give up the ego and the worry about that. When we have team meetings, it's always in a circle. I'm just another chair in the circle. Never stand up in front of them. I want to be a part of the team, but not the overseer of the team. That's not my role. My role is to give guidance and develop training design, but mostly guidance. And if you take more of a role than that, then there's some issues that brings up, potentially with trust. To get respect, you have to give it. And that also is true for your athletes. Respect the commitment they have made, always, and tell them that. Believe in the person. When you have to respond to negative behaviors, and we all do, respond to the behaviors and not the person. It's not the person that we want to get on, it's the behavior we want to deal with and try to change. You know, mistakes go with the process of learning. It's critical to understand that. Dealing with mistakes effectively and quickly is pretty critical in a team environment so that these kinds of problems do not develop into team-wide problems. But communication is a big issue, too, when it comes to dealing with individual behavioral problems. We'll talk about that shortly. Confidence. We're trying to develop self-belief. The athlete's towing the line saying, okay, just shoot the gun. I'm ready to run this race. I'm ready, go. And not looking down the line at every athlete going, wow, they look awfully strong and awfully fit, and geez, am I ready? And we don't care about that. What we want is to have a situation where that athlete totally believes in where they are at that moment. Just shoot the gun and let me run. That kind of self-confidence is a pretty powerful thing. And it is closely tied to training design. You know, for someone trained in sports psychology, over the years, with all these answers about how to treat problems and with problem athletes, etc., you know, the bottom line is this. You rarely have a problem athlete when the system is working. When the training model works, you don't have an athlete questioning themselves, you, or the training. So it's so important to have the knowledge to build a training model that's functional. Because if that athlete's improving and you have mechanisms to show that improvement, whether it be through testing and through performance measures, they can see that they are improving, you don't have a problem. You know, it's the people who are not improving, who are stagnant or worse or injured, that can be a problem. And much of that can be traced to poor training design and, frankly, to the coach. So understanding what you're doing and the rationale behind your system is pretty fundamental to having a healthy team dynamic. That's principle number three, how to promote self-belief and self-respect within the athlete. Principle four, modeling self-discipline and self-responsibility. What does a teacher do? You know, we spend a great deal of time preparing this knowledge base for us to use, and then with this passion, we try to teach them to learn. Well, knowledge and passion are great, but what we really want to teach the athlete is for them to take responsibility and have the discipline to go through this process and develop into stronger people and therefore stronger athletes. The point is this, for that to happen, we must first be disciplined and responsible if we expect the athlete to be the same. We must be disciplined and responsible ourselves first. Reflect on the values that drive our own lives. What are the values? Take a minute and write down some values that drive your behavior, your life. What are the values that we want to teach young people who are our charges, our athletes? Give some thought to that. We're going to come back to that a little bit later when we talk about developing a personal mission statement for coaching. Self-respect through discipline. If you look at the armed forces, it's grounded in discipline and respect for others and self. That respect comes through discipline. That's sort of the rationale, that comes through discipline. We have to teach people to make choices, to be disciplined in their choices. The best way to do that is to live it ourselves first, to be the role models for the young people. You're not going to get everybody all the time, but you are going to motivate others to be disciplined in their life. And once they start having success, it snowballs to other people. Self-respect comes through discipline. Discipline also provides the groundwork for courage to be trained. Courage is not a trait. A lot of people think it's a trait that we're born with. Courage is not a trait. It is a behavior that is trainable. It is trainable. So you put people in a situation where you can train courage, and that's how they earn it. It's through discipline, though. You test people, you get out of comfort zones, and you do it on a regular basis, and they earn the right to be courageous. It's just another step on the way to self-actualization. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, self-actualization, it's just another step along the way. Modeling self-discipline and self-responsibility. If we're going to teach it to our athletes, we have to first show it ourselves. That's principle number four. Principle number five, leadership starts with the coach. Have you ever thought about what a great leader is? I've been really fortunate to have some wonderful mentors in my history, both on a personal level at college and also through my athletic career. You know, it's interesting that all of them, to some degree, had this amazing way about them. They just drew people to them. It's funny how some people just have an energy or an aura about them that draws others to them. I think maybe there's something to that. We feel like there's something there that I can use, you know, that can be good for me. And I'm drawn to this person as a mentor, as a teacher. What is that? You know, that kind of energy. And what strikes me about all of these people was the enormous amount of sincerity they all had in sharing what they knew, a caring type of compassion that each of them showed toward me as a person, and a willingness to bring me in, you know, to learn from them. It's amazing. I mean, that kind of leadership where you would do anything for them kind of thing. How do we provoke that in other people? Well, I think it starts with, as coaches, in number one, knowing our sport. For people to respect us, for our athletes to respect us, to gain their trust, you must show that you've done your homework. You must show that you not only are passionate about the sport, but you're a good teacher. I mean, it's important for you to share what you know with other people. You're passionate about sharing it, not just about being passionate about the knowledge itself. But you also, there's a sincerity, I think, in great teachers and leaders. There's a true sincerity there that they want to help you. Think about that. As a coach, do we feel that with every kid we work with? I want to help this child. I want to make them stronger and better, a better athlete, a better person. There has to be sincerity there in that process. We, as coaches, when it comes to leadership, we have to require discipline. I mean, I believe children in this society at this time in our history not only require discipline, they're demanding it. And a lot of times on the surface, they'll be fighting it. But I honestly believe that kids are demanding it. They want that discipline in their life, in a life that has rarely seen discipline. And unfortunately, I think we're going the other way, where we're giving kids more and more and more freedom and without a respect to the choices they make, many of them bad choices. But we have to require discipline. And again, to do that, we have to first show that discipline ourselves. We have to reward appropriate behaviors, and we also have to punish fairly and quickly inappropriate behaviors. And I cannot stress that enough. Punish fairly and quickly the behaviors. And remember that when we do that, it is not the person that we are punishing, it is the behavior that we're punishing. We have to make the athlete feel like they are a special part of the program. Everyone needs to feel needed. Everyone has a role, no matter what their ability is. There's potential for them to learn and grow in the program, even if they're not one of those starting athletes. And that's the real challenge to us, is to help that athlete find their role and make a difference in their lives and not just the top athletes. Principle 6, communication is everything. I think goal number one for us as coaches is to learn how to be a master communicator. Coaches, my experience with coaches is that in general we are verbally very good at conveying what we want to convey. And for the most part, we are poor listeners, if not on occasion pathetic listeners. We don't necessarily read fully verbal and nonverbal cues from our athletes. One of the things that I stress in training design is that you're not necessarily going to have an athlete tell you every day that, coach, I don't feel great, or this is bothering me today, or you're going to have a kid come in and oftentimes just be quiet. They'll clam up and they won't make eye contact. They'll go through the motions and do the workout, but clearly something is going on. Well, did you take the time or the interest to even get it, that there's something out of the ordinary here? Making the contact with every athlete to make sure everything's on the up and up, that there's not a problem going on outside of athletics that day. Reading both verbal and nonverbal cues, and learning to listen well, being willing to listen well. Again, a lot of coaches like to talk, they're just not very well equipped to listen. And great listening skills are one of the great things out there for us in creating trust with people, is listening to others first. The communication cycle, interesting thing happens within communication itself. You as the coach will convey something to the athlete. I would like you to do this, this is what I'm looking for, etc. I want you to feel this or whatever. So you make that statement. Okay, that information is decoded by the athlete. They listen and they try to make sense of what you're saying. They try to read in how you say it, what you say, the words you choose, the emphasis on certain words, whatever it is that you use to convey the message. They decode that. So we assume many times as coaches that they decoded appropriately what we said. That's not always the case. So after the athlete hears what the coach says and they decode it, we often leave it alone at that point. The truth is, how do you know that they decoded it properly, that they understood what you were trying to get at? So what we have to make sure of, we have to complete that cycle. We have to go back and make sure, okay, did you get it? Do you understand what I'm saying? Tell me back what I'm after here. Make sure that they understood what you're saying. A lot of times, miscommunication is the root of a lot of problems. Complete the communication circle. Make sure they understood what you said. Also, keep communication avenues open. Make sure the communication is going on between athletes and between you. This is very important. You don't want to close any doors for communication. That kind of thing can blow up in your face as a coach, because athletes are communicating with each other. We want to make sure that that communication avenue is open between you and them. Keep the open door policy. Come by and see me over anything at any time. I'm there for you, that kind of thing. It'll pay dividends for you. In our program, we schedule personal meetings. So it's a one-on-one meeting over coffee at the coffee shop. Schedule a half hour. Don't need it all the time, but it's good to have it. Up to a half hour where you just sit and you talk. For me in cross country, it's great because at the start of the season, they come in. We go over their summer training booklet that they take. We talk a lot about their summer, what they did, what their goals are for the upcoming year. How does your semester look academically? How do you feel? What are your goals? We go through everything to kind of bring ourselves up to par on, we've missed 3 months and they've been in communication via email, but not like this. I mean, we can really sit down one-on-one and make it personal. I mean, I want them to show them that I'm interested in where they are at that moment in time and what part they're going to play in the process through the season. Principle 7, plan for success. Bottom line is this, develop a functional training model. Get out there and learn. Go to clinics. In the case of track and field, which I'm involved in, we have USA Track and Field coaching schools at different levels, up to very high level, cutting edge type schools. They're wonderful. I mean, it's the kind of stuff where it really shakes you up and makes you think about how you do things the way you do it. But do it. Get out there and learn so that you can develop a model for your sport that works, that's functional. If you don't have a functional training model, you're going to have problems. Those kids will not be successful. They will start questioning you, your program, themselves, and it can get ugly. I mean, a very difficult thing, it can unfold there. So it all is rooted in a functional training model, and that means learning, getting out there and learning. Planning for success also means keeping records. How do you know a system works? How do you know that it worked for you? You don't know unless you have records that you can go back and analyze after the fact. You can compare to last year. You can try something new this year and compare it to what you did last year because you have records. The point is, keep the records of all workouts of every athlete so that you have information to make sense of it when something doesn't go right. You'll know. Planning for success means working back from the target dates. There's a particular point, for instance, in my sports, in cross country and track, there's target dates at the end of the season. We work backward from there. Not necessarily the case for team sports, but for us, in my sports, it works out very well to work backward and develop the plan. When you have assistant coaches, I suggest daily coaches meetings. I mean, we have coaches meetings at 8 in the morning before our day really gets started. We spend a half an hour going over everything that happened the day before, any problems that may have arisen, what the plans are for this day. We talk about the upcoming competition, placement of athletes, et cetera, et cetera. But everybody has input. Everyone is on an equal spot in the room. And it really is a very special thing to have that for your assistants. Speaking of assistants, creating passion in your assistants requires that you as a coach take an interest in their growth, that you provide opportunity for their growth, and that as they grow, you reward them by giving them more and more responsibility. You know, our assistants have gotten to the point where they write the workouts. I used to write all the workouts for every event group. Now, I trust them now. I trust their knowledge base and their learning that they can now write the workouts. That is very gratifying for not just me, but also for them to know that I trust them and that they are growing to the point where they can do that on their own. We all like that. I mean, we all like taking on responsibility when it's given to us. Planning for the week and the day, I can't say enough about planning. I mean, I spend Sundays as the day when I plan the week ahead. I look at our master plan for training. I know in general what we're going to do every day. I just don't know how much of each element is going to be trained within a workout. That's done on Sunday. And then the morning of the workout, when our coaches meeting takes place, we actually formulate the specific load for that day for each event group in terms of how much and when, what the recoveries are, etc. That's done in that morning, and those are typed up on the computer and posted on the workout board. After the workouts, planning for success also means analyzing what you have done. So we have post-workout analysis and competition analysis. Every event or workout sheet for event groups at the bottom has a section that says post-workout comments. And when the workout is over, the coach writes in the comments. Those are typed into the computer and saved. So we understand on a daily basis how, I mean, imagine trying to think back 4 weeks ago for a particular workout. How did that one go? Was it too much? Was it appropriate? Etc. What was the feedback from the athlete? You have it if you took the time to write it down. It takes no more than a minute or two to do that, but it's worth it. Principle 8 is understanding that sport is part of a bigger experience for the athlete. We at Grinnell College, my wife and I, not only coach track and field and cross country, but we also teach the wellness classes there. I'm a very big believer in balance in your life. Goal number one should be the health and wellness of the athlete. Athletics is a piece of a bigger pie. It's a wonderful piece. It is what we do for a living, but it is just a piece of a bigger pie for their development. And keeping balance in that life should be the goal for the coach. Anytime you get out of balance, you could have a problem. Short story, when I was had graduated from college, I was a pole vaulter who was having a very good career back in the late 70s. I met my wife, who was high jumping for Canada, and I moved to Canada to spend a year up there while she finished her college degree, her second college degree. And while I was up there, all I could do was train. I mean, I was training 5-6 hours a day. I'd never been fitter, stronger, faster, wasn't jumping very well, but was incredibly fit. But I just couldn't jump the big jumps. I couldn't understand what it was. And the truth is, in retrospect, I ended up taking off the following outdoor season the year before the Olympic trials in 1980 because I was just fed up with the whole thing. I wasn't jumping well. I was putting all this time in. And what was happening was I put all my eggs in one basket. I was no longer in college. I didn't have a job. It was all about training. All my eggs in one basket. When it didn't work, I got so frustrated and angry about the whole thing, I just wanted to separate myself from it. The following year, I got an assistantship at Indiana University for my master's work, so I was teaching 5 classes, I was freshly married, and I was also in an accelerated master's program, 1-year master's program, which was an enormous load of classes. And I was doing all this at the same time, and it was Olympic year. So I was back training, back vaulting, but instead of training 6 hours a day, I was training an hour a day. That's all I had time for, to race over to the assembly hall at Indiana University and do my training. Then I'd go off to the library to study, to get ready for classes in the morning, and then I was teaching 5 classes. It was just an enormous load. But I had the best year ever vaulting for me in 1980 because of that. Vaulting was no longer the only piece of the pie. It was one of many. I had more balance in my life. Granted, it was a difficult year, very difficult to manage everything, but I did manage it, and everything was balanced in effect, and I had the best year ever. It was a wonderful lesson for me to realize that you can't put all your eggs in one basket. There's a lot more to the human being than just being an athlete. We need to train the person first and the athlete second. And if you really believe in that, that our goal is to mentor and create stronger people through athletics, we're on the right road. Sport is a test. It's an opportunity to get out of a comfort zone. And that's important for us. The only way we grow is to get out of our comfort zone. We understand that in terms of hypertrophy and strength training. You know, you get out of your comfort zone, you overload, and you get stronger and bigger. And it's the same way in psychosocial issues. You know, we get stronger by getting out of comfort zones. The goal, ultimately, self-actualization. And that's what we're after. It's a long process, self-actualization, as Maslow showed us with his writings. The physical versus psychological growth process. Understand that physical development comes before psychological development. That boys, for instance, develop this skill level as an athlete much earlier than they do their academic prowess. So we have to understand that as they grow and get older, the psychological development and need becomes a priority. That athletic thing develops fairly early on. And then there are other elements of the whole person that have to be addressed. So we cannot overlook the need for us as coaches to provide opportunities for them to grow mentally and psychologically and spiritually as well. Getting people stronger through the sport experience is the goal. Principle 8, sport is part of the bigger experience. Principle 9, sharing the wealth. Knowledge is borrowed, not owned. Everything we know is borrowed. We read it, someone else has thought it, taught it, and we have learned it and borrowed it. Knowledge is simply borrowed and passed on. We have no right to that, to protect that, unless it's our own and we choose to protect it and we have copyright laws and that sort of thing. But protecting what we know versus sharing it is an issue. There's a lot of coaches out there who will not share what they do for fear of giving up some secret. There are no secrets out there. People who do their homework and study how to train people, there's no need for secrets. They're doing what is appropriate based on scientific principles and common sense. Many coaches will not share what they know because of fear of not knowing enough. They don't want people to know how little they know. Be strong enough to take the first step to increase your knowledge base. And remember, confidence in your coaching begins with what you know, your knowledge base. Remember, no coaches have all the answers. The great coaches out there are the ones that will say they have the most questions because they understand it, they get it, and they're willing to share it. I've never met a great coach who is not willing to share what they know with me. And it's a very inspiring thing to see that they're comfortable enough with who they are and what they know, and they truly want to see others prosper in the athletic field by sharing what they know. That's a great leader to me. Principle number 10, teach toward independence and not dependence. Now, I left this for last because think of the analogy of raising a child. Child is born, they're totally dependent on you for everything. As they get older, they start moving away from the skirt, so to speak, and they want more independence. And sometimes they'll fool you. They really act like they want more dependence, but they don't really want it. But as time goes on, that is exactly what happens. They want more independence, and the question is, do we give it to them? Have they earned the right to that independence through the process of growing? The goal for us as coaches is to give the athlete the ability to take charge when they're ready. Do we help them get ready for that? Or do we create a dependent athlete through their career who needs us as coaches? That's a hard thing. Teaching independence is the greatest gift, in my opinion, for coaches. If we truly care about building somebody's character and their ability to believe in themselves, to take charge of their own life, are we teaching that? Are we teaching independence? And what's going to happen post-experience with athletics? Have we given them the tools to take charge of their life through athletics, or have we created the need to be dependent? It'll force us out of our comfort zone as coaches to create independence in athletes, and we as coaches have to have the courage to allow for it. This is the greatest gift, in my opinion, to teach independence to the athlete and not dependence. Some final thoughts. Take the time to sit down and write up a mission statement about what you do with athletics. What are the values that drive you as a coach? What are you trying to pass on? What do you want to teach young people? You know, it's not just about X's and O's. This stuff is at least as important as that. And if you really believe that the bigger picture, creating stronger people, is more important than creating better athletes, sure, the better athlete thing will come through the process, assuming that you have a logical and progressive training model and a healthy training environment. But aren't we really interested in the bigger picture? Get excited about learning. Read everything you can, talk to other coaches, go to clinics, and be willing to get out of your comfort zone. Make the time to connect with your athletes on a personal level. Every athlete wants to feel needed. They're just waiting for you to make them feel needed. If you make them feel a part of it, imagine what they can offer. You really can create a situation where the sum is greater than the parts. Be a leader by example. You're the first model they'll look to for direction. You'll always be the first model, so make sure that you're practicing what you expect them to do. Expect a lot of your athletes, but first expect a lot of yourself. Children want to be challenged. And that begins with us challenging ourselves as the model. Keep a journal. Keep a record of everything so you can go back and analyze later. I'd like to finish with a story close to home. When I was a young kid in high school, I grew up in Kentucky. A pole vaulter, basketball player, baseball player who ended up taking up the pole vault and ended up being better at that than the other sports. And really, I knew that was my avenue to college. So I accepted the scholarship to the University of Florida, and which was somewhat difficult growing up in Lexington, Kentucky. Of course, Kentucky is in the SEC with Florida. But I also knew that that was the place for me to go. It had the weather. It had great coaching. It had the defending national champ back for his senior year, and it had the world record holder moving into town from Rice University to train. And in fact, the three of us trained together for my whole career down there until we all retired. I was fortunate, but I was most fortunate to have the coach I had. He passed away a couple of years ago, and I was unable to get down to the funeral because of a commitment with my coaching. But I did write this to be read at his funeral, and I wanted to share it with you because, you know, you don't really think about the power of a mentor, of someone, until something like this happens, and I hope you will think about it. But it really, he touched me in a lot of ways, and I wanted to share this with you. This is what I asked to be read at the funeral for me. I met Walter Welch as a young freshman at the University of Florida. I had been recruited by Jimmy Carnes to pole vault for the Gators. It was an exciting time for this young Kentucky boy who had never been on an airplane until he flew to Gainesville to go to school. I was immediately taken with Walt Welch. I wasn't sure what to make of this guy who always had a story or a joke, some better than others, but what I learned over time was that he would always be there for me. He was by the pit the day I first made 16 feet. He was there the day I first made 17 feet, and the day I won the National Junior Championships on my home track. The starter of the meet that day, I remember him coming by the pit afterwards and saying, "You know, I knew all along you'd win this thing." Just another vote of confidence, and I believed him when he said it. He was a lot more confident than I was that day. But it wasn't just that he was my pole vault coach at UF. There was something much more about this man that made him special to me. He took an interest in me as a person. He saw talent in me that I didn't. I saw him as a coach, as an employer. I lifeguarded for him in the summers at a private pool that he managed. and as a teacher, I took several classes from him at the university. Over the 7 years I spent in Gainesville, I was part of a special circle of people involved with the pole vault. Mike Cotton, Dave Roberts, Jimmy Carnes, and Walt Welch. All were special to me for different reasons, but Walt Welch was unique for a very special reason. He always made me feel like I was the most important athlete on the track or in his classroom. I truly enjoyed being with him. There were many who knew more about vaulting, but few who would impact me the way he did. He simply cared about me as a person and not just me, the vaulter. I myself ended up going into teaching and coaching, and I've always tried to measure myself against what I saw in Walter Welch. Teach with passion, care about the person, make time for people, and be a friend. There are no better goals as a teacher and coach than to strive for those things with your students. When the athletic experience is over, what you have left is friendship and respect and thanks. I honor and respected Walt Welch. I couldn't have had a better coach or a friend, and he knew it because I told him. Make sure you tell those who matter to you how you feel about them, because the greatest lessons we learn can't be bought with money. They come from the heart, and don't be afraid to share it. I wish you luck, coaches. Coaching is a great field. It's a way to really make a difference in this world and have a purpose. Working with young people is so exciting, but it's also an enormous challenge. Get out there and learn and do it from the heart. I know you'll succeed. Best of luck.